Welcome to South Beach Sessions. I am Dan Lebatard. I have said before on television and in radio that Bomani Jones is better at the sports opinion business than anyone I have ever seen in this medium. There are no exceptions. He is better at giving you unique thoughts that you haven't heard when asked questions than anyone else I've ever seen in this business. You should check out his podcast, The Right Time with Bomani Jones. You can get it wherever it is you get your podcasts. I wanted to talk to him a little bit about everything going on in America because I always find him insightful on matters echoing throughout the country. But beyond that, I also wanted to show you a side of him that perhaps you have not seen before or heard before because Bomani gives off, and it's real, a huge amount of confidence, but that's not always been so. When he started in his career, he had some setbacks that he will tell you about here that I think you will find illuminating and vulnerable. Before we get to that, though, here's Mike Ryan to tell you who is sponsoring this week's South Beach Session. So of all the things to happen in sports, Bomani, the Confederate flag in NASCAR, the Red Sox playing the Black National Anthem, the NHL coming out with an end racism type of vibe, which has been the one that's been most surprising to you? Which is the one that you thought you'd never see in your lifetime?
Man, it's like we got a running list of these things, right? Like I thought that we would see Washington change the name of that team at some point. The Confederate flag one, I think that was a little bit trickier just because I think that it had reached a point where people had just kind of given up on the idea of it ever happening. The one that I mean, you may hit it right there. The Boston Red Sox putting Black Lives Matter on Fenway Park right off the freeway for everybody to see and not just doing it, but with no compunction whatsoever about whether or not anybody was going to be mad. Like, that's the biggest difference, is that all this stuff has been like, yo, we don't want to make a particular set of white people mad. They don't even care. They're just like, nah, this is what we're going to do. What you going to say?
Why is it important to make white people uncomfortable? Why can none of this happen in the way of progress without that discomfort?
Well, It's not about, like, intrinsically why it's important to make white people uncomfortable. What you can't do is worry about making white people uncomfortable, right? Because, look, the world is as it's been for a big reason, which is we have prioritized white people over everybody else for so long. And so even the people who call themselves on the side of right, it's hard for them to see some of these changes. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard for them to imagine these things happening and some of the things that intellectually they think are okay, like feel a little bit funny to them on the side. You got to push through that because if like the point at which white people are going to be uncomfortable, and this is like the point at which men are going to be uncomfortable when it comes to matter of gender, where straight people are going to be uncomfortable when it comes to matters of sexual orientation. As that happens, if you stop when people get uncomfortable, then you're never going to get anything done. It's almost like working out, right? Like if you stop when it burns, you're never going to get stronger.
How is it that you have experienced personally the last couple of months?
That's interesting. Like, for me, I have been stunned by how many people have been willing to listen. Like, I think it's far the farther along we go in this, we also find out how many people are unwilling to listen. But I have been surprised by the fact that George Floyd hit people in such a way to make all these folks look up and recognize, okay, we're going to have to do things just a little bit differently. I feel like part of it is I think that people who matter and people with power recognize that order is getting shaky. Like once you start having people out in the streets for as long as people have been out in the streets and what you got politically going on right now, maintaining order is a difficult situation. And so I think that for a lot of people, they needed to keep this under control. They needed to make sure that this did not set on fire in the streets, regardless of who it was setting it on fire in the streets. Like, that was the part that they wanted to maintain. And in the course of that, what we've seen is a lot of young people primarily making pushes and demanding that they are treated, basically they're demanding the morality that the companies that they work for, that those companies purport to uphold, they're demanding that they actually do it because people don't get paid enough in order to swallow their principles in the name of getting a pity little check. They just don't. And so what we've seen is what the potential of the future can be. What we've seen is people in charge who have made the decision that it's better for them to get in front of these things rather than be forced to do these things. And so as much as I've been skeptical about where this will all ultimately go, I'm still like wildly optimistic that we've seen enough people in the course of the last 2 months or so who recognize that things have to change, even if it's not because they think they have to change because of some matter of principle, even if they have to change just because they realize the change is what's necessary to maintain and hold on to the little that we got left of what was a civilized society. Seeing that happen, like I say, it is encouraging, and at times it's been pretty damn surprising.
What do you think Colin Kaepernick is seeing when he watches what's happening now? Because I think I would have a degree of anger inside me. You know, happiness that it finally arrived, but anger that it's basically cost my career and it's spent, you know, I've spent the last 4 years not being able to play football.
Yeah, I think the worst part of this is, and maybe this is going to take like 20-something years to uphold, right? Like maybe it's going to take, once we get to the point where people are giving Colin Kaepernick a lifetime achievement awards, like maybe that's what it's going to take for people to look at him and give him the props, not just the props, but just like the dignity that he deserves after what happened to him. But yeah, I'd be frustrated as hell if me kneeling for the national anthem caused all these problems and now everybody else does it. I'd be mad. But there's a very specific reason why I'd be mad if I were him. And it's not just the idea that the corporations and everybody else have co-opted what he did. Never forget, we are not here because he did not stand for the national anthem. We are not here because he knelt for the national anthem after he did not stand for the national anthem. We are here because when they asked him to talk about the national anthem and why he did not stand, he explicitly stated, I am doing this because of the mistreatment of black people in the United States, and used words like oppressed and everything else. Because you think about this, a whole lot of guys, forget about kneeling, did not stand at all for the national anthem. Marshawn Lynch in this time period stopped standing for the national anthem, just sitting over there by the water cooler. But he never answered any questions as to why. And in the last 4 years, we've seen Marshawn Lynch become like a cuddly, beloved figure across the board. People love Marshawn Lynch now, even though he did not stand for the national anthem. Kaepernick did the kneeling thing as a compromise after he met with Nate Boyer, you know, a serviceman, and they decided that that was the way to accomplish both his goal, Colin's goal of not wanting to stand for the national anthem, which he shouldn't have to do if he doesn't feel like it, right? Not standing for the national anthem while also not being seen as being disrespectful toward the military and all that stuff that got conflated into this, right? So he got this because he said, I will not do this while black people are being oppressed. That is what he got in trouble for. That's what the issue was. The kneeling was always something to please the masses. For the masses to then use kneeling and to stop it from being any level of protest, but rather turn it simply into a demonstration, yeah, that act has been neutered. That's why when somebody says they're not kneeling for the national anthem, I don't have any problem with it, because we ain't going to make you do that. We're not going to make that compulsory the way we tried to make standing for the national anthem compulsory. We're not going to do that. And I wonder for Kaepernick himself how he feels about this idea that everybody now, in order to like pass the purity test, has to kneel for the national anthem. And he's got to be like, nah, it ain't ever what this was. Remember, the first time he did, he just sat by the water cooler.
Are we really in a place where Myers-Leonard now, because this is flip, that the distinction you're making there between protest and demonstration, where the bravery is doing what Myers-Leonard did, where he's standing and then bringing that attention to himself, then explaining it in a way that it's hard to object to, given his military, family's military history, combined with the idea that he's articulating, hey, I support Black Lives Matter. I'm just not kneeling in front of a flag.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting, though, like, I don't think that really took that much courage, man. He's still a white man doing this. White man ain't got to have no hard time explaining why he's standing for the national anthem. Like, you might have a hard time explaining that to the other black people, right? But even then, I don't think that was that difficult of a sell for him. The truth is, for him, no matter who you are, if you feel like standing for the national anthem, stand for the national anthem. If you don't feel like standing for the national anthem, don't stand for the national anthem. Like, we have lost that was the original point of this, and where it always should have been was, you don't have to do this, right? We are not a country where you are required to participate in this, like, demonstrative patriotism in that way. That was always the point to me. And so it goes in the other direction. If you don't feel like standing, you don't have to. Like when Jonathan Isaac did what he did, the problem for me was not that he did not kneel during the national anthem or that he did not wear a shirt. Is that what he said was so stupid, right? Like his point just didn't stand up. It didn't hold any water in this situation. But with Leonard, I think we got to be careful. It didn't take that much courage. He just needed to be able to explain it to his teammates. And my understanding is he explained it to his teammates in Miami. He explained it to the guys that he used to deal with in Portland. But where I disagree, not disagree with him, because I guess he gets to do it how he wants. This flag and this national anthem are not the exclusive property of the United States military. Like, this wasn't always the case where we just directly conflated those two ideas. Now, I know that the idea of playing the national anthem and sporting events derives from, like, wartime efforts and the like. Like, I get that part. But I have always had a problem that we're going to act like the idea is that the flag and the anthem are all about the military when I thought they were about the country. Now, if you want to say that the country and the military are the same thing, that's a scary thought.
What do you do with the opportunists who make an appearance, like the Atlanta Dreams owner or that OKC politician who was saying that he's going to withhold tax benefits if the players keep kneeling? The number of opportunists that are making an appearance, the guy who makes an appearance with, I'll never watch another NBA basketball game again.
Yeah, you're about the guy that hasn't watched an NBA basketball game in like 20 years, right? Like the guy who says I'll never watch the NBA again either hasn't watched the NBA in forever or will continue to watch the NBA. Like no matter who that person happens to be. Now the thing with Loeffler, the owner of the Dream, that's so interesting about her is we have to remember that she was appointed to that seat in the Senate. She's never won an election. And from what people in Georgia are telling me, she's probably not going to make it to the runoff in this. So she's trying to figure out how to campaign and make this happen, and she's used her basketball team basically as a prop. Like, there's no way in the world that if you have a real objection to the progressive politics of the WNBA that you only started caring about that while you were running a campaign. This is what this league has been for a very, very long time. And now she's jumped out and decided, hey, this is going to be my campaign plank. Except the problem is nobody in your little local municipality cares about that basketball team. Like, you're getting national noise about this and people are having a discussion that surrounds you, but this isn't even going to help her accomplish the goal that she wants. But we keep putting her on TV, and that's what we got to stop doing. It's like, we in sports in particular, we understand what it is that she's doing. I would make an argument that we have probably given more coverage in sports to Kelly Loeffler's opposition, what the WNBA is doing, to than we've given to what the WNBA is actually doing. Like, that's how backwards that is. Now, in Oklahoma, one thing I've learned over the course of time, they'll let anybody be a member of a state legislature. Like, anybody at all. You'd be like if you start looking around and going through these states, or even think about your own state, or think about if you know somebody that's a state senator or a state representative, that bar ain't that high. Don't nobody really want to do that job, right? Anybody gets that. So then this person in Oklahoma is like, yeah, well, what we're going to do, we'll put taxes on the Thunder. You ain't about to put no taxes on the Thunder. Y'all want that basketball team to be there too bad. You tell that to Clay Bennett, and Clay Bennett's like, you know, we can't just move back to Seattle and watch them tax things go away.
The whataboutism that makes an appearance when people are saying, yeah, social justice in the NBA, but what about China? How do you dismantle that position?
So I think there are two different discussions to be had here, right? One of them is the fact that Adam Silver needs to answer for what the NBA is doing in China, period, right? And he has not given a real answer for it. And I understand what the dilemma is for the NBA on this, which is, they don't feel like they got so much growth potential left in the United States. The growth potential for them is in China and around the world. And what is different about the NBA versus the three other major sports, so I guess the NHL, it might be a little different, but the difference between them and Major League Baseball and football is baseball and football are American games. Basketball is a global game. The money is around the world, and 1/6 of the people in the world live in China. The only reason I feel like the NFL and Major League Baseball are not engaged in the same problem the NBA is engaged in is that China don't really want them to come over there. If China wanted them over there, they'd be over there trying to get that money too. Now, the next level of this that I think is important, and everybody's got to remember here, is that when it comes to talking about race, primarily for white people, that is a discussion that they have with each other. It is not a discussion they really have with black people. Like, that's why if you really notice that a lot of the rhetoric that the right wing of the United States has toward the left when it comes to racism is in the vein of, you guys aren't any less racist than we are. Like, that's what it always seems to come down to when you really get down to it, that the right, when they look at the left, they want to call out the left for hypocrisy on race. They don't actually want to talk about racism. They want to talk about how, oh, so how you good with this one thing, but you're not good with this other thing. And that is what permeates the discussion that you see coming up from people about the NBA in China. It is. And the Fatal Ruse in that story that they did for ESPN about it, they put in an unnamed quote in there that honestly the editors should have hacked and taken completely out of there, which was, how are we saying that we're doing something for Black History Month, but we're not doing anything about what's going on in China? Why in the world are you specifying Black people right now when you talk about this? The NBA has all kinds of measures that they engage in that are supposedly for the greater good that would be in conflict with their relationship with China. But the only one that you want to point to is the one about Black people, right? Like, that weapon is being used as either why the NBA shouldn't be talking about these things involving Black people, or B, why they're not really sincere in what they're saying about Black people. And the why they're not really sincere in what they're saying about Black people goes right back to what I just said, which is that the discussion for race with white people primarily is a discussion that they have amongst themselves, as each side tries to say that the other side is the one that is really racist. And that's what infuriates me about this when it comes down, is you can talk about what the NBA is doing in China without ever mentioning what they're doing with Black people one time. Now, if your argument is, well, the NBA positions itself as being the woke league, I don't even know if the NBA positions itself so much as that, as much as white fans of the NBA like to hold up that their league is more progressive than the other leagues. And what's that about? Once again, that is about white people having a discussion about race that is among themselves. And so if you want to bang on the NBA for what they're doing in China, I'm right here with you to do it. I'm just saying, leave me and mine out of it, because we really ain't got shit to do with that.
I'm curious. I mean, you've already lived this, right? For how many years, with every time that somebody said something about police officers killing Black people, you'd get, what about Chicago? What about the black-on-black crime in Chicago?
Yes, yeah, that's what this is. It's what about China now. But I tell you this, though, this is what gets me about the China part in the way that it gets positioned. And this was, to a degree, something that came up with the DeSean Jackson and Steven Jackson things when they arose, which is a lot of the anti-blackness of so-called allies jumped to the forefront when those issues came up right then and there. So with the thing with Jackson, both of them were obviously wrong, and there was no disputing the fact that these guys were wrong. At least as far as I'm concerned, there was no disputing the fact that these guys were wrong, right? Like, it was just kind of, it was ridiculous, it was problematic, it was all these things. But all of a sudden, people that I had never heard say nothing about the treatment of Black people by police for years and years and years, and just popped up with a couple tweets after George Floyd, now those people are coming in my face talking about, if you're going to be opposed to hate, you have to be opposed to all hate. And if you won't say anything about their anti-Semitism, then I don't want to hear what you have to say about Black people. So what you're telling me is you were just looking for a reason to not have to say anything about Black people? Is that what it is? Those two things don't have to go together. Like, this isn't a trade, right? Like, you're basically telling me that in order for you to care about my dignity, that has to be bartered? Because I'll tell you, I have had concerns for a lot of different white people and the way they have been treated by society without them ever giving a damn about me, and I never tried to extort their concern in that way. Like, I never did that. Like, the what about that comes up, I didn't do that. And I saw a lot of people that I would consider to be allies on these matters try to make the exact same point right there. Just say, if you're going to care about one, then you have to care about another. Everybody's letting white people jump in and out of this as they so choose to decide when they care. Everybody's allowing them to do that. The only people that anybody's trying to say got to be on this side all the time is when you dare say something about Black people. And I believe this. One of my buddies told a story once about the Atlanta child murders. You remember that in the late 70s, early 80s? Yes. Black kids just turned up missing and dead in Atlanta. And he told me he was very young, white dude. And he was fascinated by the case because he was a weird old kid, right? He was just really fascinated. And he said that he was talking to his grandfather, and his grandfather said, "You don't care about that, do you?" And he said, "No." And his grandfather asked him why, and he said he gave him an answer at like 6 or 7 years old because he knew this was the right answer. And he said, "Because nobody cares about what happens to black people." Like, at 5 or 6 years old, this dude knew that that was the answer at the time. And there's something fundamental about a lot of what goes on here is people understanding and believing that they're not actually supposed to care about what happens to black people. So whenever there's a back door for these folks to stop acting like they care about black people, they take it. And I think that that is what China is being used as with the NBA.
So what do you say, though, to the people who point out Chicago again and again? You've been on the show. One of the best segments you did on the show was talking about just how rampant discrimination has made Chicago the killing zone that it is. You say what when the argument ends up there, where someone is saying, well, yes, police officers kill white people as well. Police officers kill black people, and Chicago, black on black crime, that's not white on black crime. What am I supposed to say to those people?
You. That's what you say to those people. You say, you. And the reason we say that is I'm not engaging bad faith arguments anymore. Like, I've made that decision. Like, when I know that people are not operating in good faith, I'm not engaging in that anymore. Those people are not looking to have their minds changed. They're not looking for logic to turn them around in that discussion. The other part of it is this. Let black people start going on a killing spree, right? Not even a spree, right? Like, let's just find out that it's some black people going around the city, whether they got uniforms or not, right? Let's say there's some black people going around the city just killing folks, right? Killing five, let's call it 5-10 a year. And they're just like, you know, and getting away with it, right? Like, these black people are getting into court and they're getting away with it. Why? Because black people are allowed to kill white people, which is basically the police are just allowed to kill people, right? And so, and black people, white people, whatever, the police are just kind of allowed to do it. And so if there were black people that were allowed to kill folks, and they were going to trial, and they were getting off, or not even going to trial, because they're like, hey, they're black people get to kill people, right? If they were doing that, imagine if my response was, well, what about white-on-white crime? Because most white people are killed by other white people. Murder is a crime primarily of proximity. Wouldn't nobody entertain that? You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing in the world there. Like, you think about all the, like, the country that we had, and I think Emmett Till's birthday just passed recently. And Emmett Till was murdered as a 15-year-old because some white dudes thought that he had made a pass at a white woman, right? And they decided that they were just going to go out and they were just going to kill that boy. What, none of them concerned about white-on-white crime? What, none of them concerned about white-on-white rape? What, none of them concerned about any of that stuff? The only people that are supposed to be concerned about that are black people. And what makes it terrible is the discussion of black-on-black crime is a relevant one for black people to have with each other. And by the way, a conversation that black people have with each other all the time. But this ain't nothing that white people actually care about. They only care about it, and it only gets mentioned as a reason to not talk about something else. And that's why I don't engage these people when they say, what about Chicago? They say, what about Chicago? I feel like the new trick needs to be to overwhelm them with other cities. Well, what about Baltimore? Well, what about Philadelphia? Well, what about, you know what I mean? Like the fact that they all go to the same city. You think Chicago's the only place where black people out here getting killed? Why are you out here neglecting Los Angeles? Why are you out here neglecting Houston or any of these other places where this stuff happens? So if these people are going to engage in bad faith, man, fuck them.
I don't mean to take you into the sensitive area of religion, but I would like to understand why it is that polling shows that white Christians are more likely to deny systemic racism than just about any other group.
No, it's not hard. It's that the church has been defending that racism for a very long time. Like, this is something that happened with Trump is, in spite of everything about Trump, right? And let's imagine that we're in a world before Donald Trump is president. And it's important to do that because once he becomes the president, like, everything he does becomes like this protected political class of stuff that you can't really talk about, right? So let's just look at everything that Trump did before he became the president of the United States. nothing of that screams out evangelical Christianity. None of it does. None of it is in line with, like, the morality that people would claim that they want a Christian to uphold. And the evangelicals have made it clear throughout time that they think it is important that the president be an upstanding Christian man. It's a big part of why Barack Obama could get enough of that vote from that world when he could, is his upstanding Christianity, right? Like, that, there's a thing there. All right. So the evangelicals supported Trump, white evangelicals, overwhelmingly in the 2016 election, which tells you that it wasn't really that much about religion, right? It wasn't really that much about faith, because Trump is demonstrates himself clearly as a man who is not one of faith. Like, he's made that very clear. And so the fact that in droves, evangelical Christians voted for Trump laid bare that what they were voting for and what their politics are not about actual religion. But if you go look and talk to people, and there are historians, there's a few guys that you can check out on Twitter. Let me make sure I get this one guy's name right. I think it's Jared Sexton. He's a professor at Georgia Southern. And he tweets often about evangelical Christianity and growing up in that world and what the lessons that they learn in that world, how they tie to the racial social order. But think about this, like a guy like Jerry Falwell. Well, now I guess we're at Jerry Falwell Jr., but both generations of Falwell. Those are ministers that are running a, you know, ostensibly a church-based organization. Go look at what their politics are on race. And there are people who follow those folks. And so if you are a person that follows that man, then you are probably going to either pick up the things he says about race, or you're there because you agree with the things that he says about race. And so I think we could put it on the church in part. We could say that it's the church that's doing this, and I do think the church, you know, pushes out a lot of those messages. But the truth is, it's America. And white Christians are white Americans, and racism has been a dominant value in the United States since the very, very beginning. And people have to understand that that is not a bug. It's much more a feature.
Bo, you're embarking here on a really cool project, and I don't know what's public or what's private about it. What can you tell people about the journalism that's coming up in a national magazine?
Yeah, so I've been working for about the last month or so on a long-form magazine project that I am personally really, really, really excited about. I've never written anything in this way. Taking on a fairly meaty and weighty and currently relevant topic as it relates to sports, working with one of my favorite people in the industry, someone I respect as much as anybody else who's out here. And I think it's stuff that's going to wind up being, I think it's going to be something that can make a real impact. And I'm ready for this. Like, I, you know, Dan, you know this about me, is that I have a love-hate relationship with writing, as I'm reading over a draft as we speak of something else that's going up right now. And so for me to kind of lock in for a period of time and make all these phone calls and talk to these people and play around with the ideas and throw it up and down, like, that's big for me. That's big for me. And so I'm super duper excited about making that happen.
You've had a wrestling match. I don't know how vulnerable you care to get with the audience, but you've had a wrestling match with writing. It's one of the few places, as a youngster, I guess, I don't think that that's the case anymore so much, but as a youngster, it's one of the few places that I have seen someone else able to take some of your confidence.
Yeah, I'll tell you kind of the story on this. It's actually very interesting. I worked for ESPN.com as a columnist for Page Two. I did, like, freelance work, and then in 2006, I was given a contract to write for ESPN, and that contract was not renewed. At the end of the year, I had a poor relationship with my editor at the time, and I believed that that editor did not want me there and did what he could to make sure that I would no longer be there. And a couple of days ago, a gentleman who worked at ESPN, a guy who brought me on to write the column, not the same editor, but brought me on to be a columnist, and he announced that he was leaving the company after 25 years, and I said congratulations to him. And, you know, thank him. He brought me on at this company, even if I was only there for so long, right? He replied that doing that was one of the best moves that he made while he worked at the company. But he also, you know, was on board when they fired me, right? And so I hit him up, and I said, that other move, not you. right? And it was funny because, like, behind the curtain, he was like, yeah, it was gracious of you not to say in public and all of those things. And for me, it was kind of an interesting moment because I had to overcome that, man. Like, I really felt like I was working for somebody who just wanted to batter my confidence, who wanted to demonstrate that I wasn't supposed to be there. Like, he just did not like the idea that I worked at that place. And you got to understand, when this happens, I'm like 26, 27 years old. You know, like, I'm young, and I feel like if you go back and read the work that I was writing when I was 25 or 26, you wish you were writing that stuff when you were 25 and 26. Like, I go back now and read things that I hated at the time, and I'm like, wow, this is what I was doing when I was 25, because I had basically been told that what I was doing was just not good enough. I was not sufficient as a writer. And I was raw, and I was untrained, and I was learning things as I went, and so I always had that kind of, like, apprehension as it went. And I just remember once I was supposed to go cover the ACC tournament in 2007 in Tampa, and I was trying to write something in advance of it, but I was so busy and I had so many different things that I was trying to do. I'd never been more busy in my life. And then after the tournament, which was in Tampa, I was supposed to go down to Clearwater to talk to BJ Upton for some other story that was something I'd never done before and all of this. And I just remember right before I was supposed to go to Tampa, I sent in a piece for it to be published. And I mean, it wasn't very good, right? And sometimes this happens. Dan, you can talk about this. When you got to write X amount of pieces per week, they're not all going to be good. And that one was honestly not good, but little did I know, they had big plans for that piece that wasn't good. And so my editor replies to me, copied to all the other editors, about how the piece was bad, is that it kind of sucked, and it read like most of your work has read lately. And then I called and I said, you know, I apologize, but then I asked, I was like, so when you say this reads like most of my work has read, what does that mean? Because I can't correct it if you don't tell me. Like, if everything I'm doing is whack and you haven't told me and I don't even know how far back this goes, like, what does that mean? Can you tell me what I'm doing wrong? And then they would not tell me. So you're dropping me off at the ACC tournament, which is actually not that interesting to most people. Dropping me off at the ACC tournament, and I got to file every day, and all I know is that everything I do stinks, and I have no idea. And I remember that Saturday night, the championship game is on Sunday, the Saturday game's in the afternoon. Saturday night, I went to dinner with a couple of guys that I eventually wound up working with for years. And I went to dinner with them, and I remember they paid for dinner, which is, like, so cool to me because I couldn't believe somebody would pay for my food. And we went to dinner, and I came back, and my head was pounding. My stomach was in a knot. Like, I remember I went in the bathroom, I threw up, and that got the headache away, and I fell asleep on the floor because I was just so stressed and just so unsure with no idea if I was doing anything right or if I was doing anything wrong, and nobody was giving me any feedback. I just remember it was the worst and most miserable feeling that I have ever had as a professional. Nothing has ever felt that bad. And I just, after that, I never really recovered from the idea that maybe every now and then I could write something really good, but as a writer, maybe I just wasn't that good. And I had believed that I was approaching excellent. Like, I knew I had to get better, but I thought that I was approaching excellent. And those tire treads, man, those are on my back for a while.
Just crazy to think how that happened, because I got to imagine somewhere within your vomiting, as you've been on the journey, you descend from academics, you end up in college at like 15 years old, you're brilliant by any measure, and you choose this unusual career after, you know, getting multiple masters in sophisticated learning. You decide, I'm going to write, which is, it seems like a crazy choice. And then you're throwing up because people are telling you, nah, this chance you've taken, this bravery you've shown, nah, you're not good enough.
What I didn't recognize at the time and that I get now is that there are some people who, for whatever reason, and it sounds dramatic, and I want to be careful because it sounds dramatic to be like, he was trying to destroy me. Or like my favorite line from Making the Band, I feel like y'all are trying to assassinate my career, right? Like, you know, nobody wants to be that guy that talks in those dramatic terms, except for the fact that I don't know if the dude wanted to assassinate my career, but he didn't want me there anymore. Like, you know, that was just, and I remember when they called me to tell me that they were letting me go, they let me know that a lot of other changes were going to take place. And I paid attention to that site for at least another year. There wasn't no a lot of changes that took place. Nobody else got that treatment. I did. I was the one person who got that treatment. And so, like, imagine working at a place that at the time had a reputation for not firing anybody, and then they fire you.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry to laugh. It is such a cool success story, though. Seriously, Bomani, from that to where you are now is really f-ing cool.
Yeah, no, it was, you know, and it's wild that it happened back here, right? And there's a lot of backdoor stuff that happened, you know, in order for me to wind up coming back to the company, which is something that in 2007 I never, ever considered would happen ever again. But, like, I remember I was on the phone. I called one of my previous editors to let them know that they had not renewed my contract. And I think I may have been at the airport at the time. I can't remember, but I just remember I just broke down crying. Like, it was the year that I was under that contract had ultimately proved to be so painful, and it started off so exciting. Like, I felt like I was doing a lot of good work. Like, I felt like a professional. You know, I got a full-time national job writing as a columnist on ESPN.com on my site at Page Two, which was my favorite thing in the world at the time. And, like, I felt so accomplished. I just remember it all ended, and I just broke down crying. Like, I just couldn't take it. Like, it was such an awful, terrible feeling that I had about it. And then I remember I called my buddy Adam Gold, works at the radio station 99.9 The Fan in Raleigh. And this is when 850 The Buzz was the station at the time, and I had done a little fill-in work for them. And I called him, and I remember I just wanted to, like, whine and complain about how I had been mistreated. And Adam, who I love to death, really ain't here for listening to your whining. That's just not his wiring. But I remember as I called to do my whining, and Adam was like, so this means you can do radio now? Like, he was completely off of whatever this writing thing was and what had happened. His thing was, so you can do radio now. And then I talked to Adam later, and Adam said, look, here's what I want. I want to do a show. I want you to host our show here on Saturday morning. You and Shannon Penn have chemistry from your fill-in work, so I'd like for him to wind up, you know, to produce that show. And he said, this summer we're going to have an opening for Afternoon Drive, and if it goes like I think it will with you in the morning, then you will be the person to fill in on Afternoon Drive for the summer, and then we will figure out the rest from there. And look, that changed the course of my career. That changed the course of my life. I mean, that changed the direction of Shannon's career in a lot of ways. Like everything came together for me that was going to be the building of the rest in that moment right there, because that dude did not want to listen to me talk about complaining about writing. But what was wild about it is that while I was there, they had a blog that they were running and everybody could kind of get in on it. And what ultimately happened was I had a place to write. Like, if I wanted to write, I didn't have editorial support or whatever, but I had a place that if I wanted to do something, I could write things. Like, I decided that I was going to report on John Wall's recruitment in 2009. And when I needed to write something about that, I could write about it on that site. And, like, I basically, like, autodidactically, in a lot of ways, got better at writing by getting away from an editor, because all that editor did was beat the hell out of me.
You can see how good Bomani has gotten at writing at The Undefeated, where he just did a story about everything going on in the Pac-12, and also coming soon, not too many details available at the moment, he's doing something that is a really, really cool project. Do you want to tell the people how close through that journey you were to not ever doing Highly Questionable?
Yeah, I can do that. That almost changed. This is how the story goes. I feel like we're years removed from this, so we can talk about it. So I was looking for work in the spring of 2013, and that was actually a very good time to be looking for work, the spring of 2013, because NBC Sports was starting their operation. Fox Sports 1 was getting off of the ground. Like, it was just a lot of people looking for content. CBS Sports was kind of getting their thing going. And I had been doing Around the Horn at that point for about 2.5 years, and it kind of made an impact in that space. And so I had all kinds of different people who were really, really interested in me. And Fox was one of those companies. And Fox at the time, I think Fox Sports Live, their nighttime show, was where they really wanted to kind of focus what they were doing. And at least the way they spun it to me was they wanted to have me on that show with some other people, but they, like, wanted to build that show around me. Like, they were selling me with the idea that they wanted to, that this is what they wanted it to be, that they wanted to be me. I was like, okay, cool. And they offered what at the time seemed like more money than anybody would ever offer me in my life, you know? So I was with it. And we came around to ESPN, and we're like, hey, guys, we're, you know, Bomani's looking for a job here. And the response from them was that they didn't have any inventory, which is to say, we ain't got no openings, basically, right? Like it was like I was coming to give an application to the manager, and the manager's like, well, we'll keep this on file if something comes up. And they just said they didn't have anything for whatever reason. And so I went for it. I mean, I waited on it, but there was nothing there. And so I was going to go to Fox Sports 1. I was going to move to L.A., and I was going to work with them. And at some point in that, I get a call from John Skipper, and he says that he would like to talk. And I say, oh, okay. And so we kind of talk a little bit about what's going on, and it sounded like ESPN could be a good thing, but I had basically given my word to some other people that I was going there. And so I was like, look, if you guys are going to want to have me here, then you're going to have to step up on this money, right? Because I'm basically making it such that I can't go work for this other place ever again. Like, you're going to have to make it worth it. And the money that ESPN then offered was not bad, but it wasn't what I thought at the time was sufficient for me to break my word. And so, again, I haven't signed anything, but I'm going to go work for Fox. That's my plan. That's what I think is going to happen. It just so happened that while this is all going on, I had a trip to Miami scheduled. I'd never been to Miami before, but I had a trip to Miami scheduled because my tailor was in Miami, and my tailor didn't come to North Carolina, right? Like, this wasn't on his list of stops. So my tailor...
Your tailor has taken so much of your money over the years. Every time Bomani wants to buy 3 suits and he leaves with 10.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. And by the way, that time when I met the tailor, I bought literally like $15,000 worth of clothes because I thought I was going to be on a 3-hour TV show, and I had plans for like costume changes and stuff, you know? And so anyway, I go to Miami to meet the tailor, but also while I'm there, I go and do Highly Questionables. Well, the studio was out in Hialeah, and I go out to do, at the time it was Dan Lebatard is Highly Questionable. I went and did that, and we did that show for 2 days. And I got up, and I left the last day, and I'm leaving Miami, and I called my agent. Because you remember, you and I were basically thinking this was it. I didn't think I was ever going to do another television day on ESPN ever again.
I was so bummed. I was so bummed. They had lost you. As far as I was concerned, they had lost you. You weren't going to burn the bridge on the promises you'd make.
Yeah, it was done. Like, it wasn't going to happen. There was no way that this was going to go down. And then I left. I went home. And I was bummed for a couple of days, right? I was just like, man, what am I going to do? And then I called my agent, and I was like, hey, man, we gotta talk about this, man. I don't know, man. Like, I feel like I might be walking away from what might be a bad idea. And then I remember I talked to Whitlock. Or I may not have talked to Whitlock. Or Whitlock may have told you and sent it through me at a time where we did things like talk to Whitlock. And Whitlock was like, so wait a minute. So you're telling me that he's just going to make this deal because of money? And that really stuck with me. Like, that was, you know, it's kind of ironic for a number of reasons, but it really stuck with me. It's like, you really going to do this because of money? And I was just like, okay, I'm not sure about this. And then we wound up on another phone call with John Skipper, and it was me, my agent, John Skipper, and somebody else. And Skipper started talking about this, and Skipper started talking about that and everything else. And I remember I just sat there, and I listened to him while we were on the call. I listened, and we got off the phone. And the thing I remember is John Skipper, for those of you who are familiar with John Skipper, former president of the company, he has this very thick southern accent. Like, you know, like a fiction writer would refer to it as like bourbon tinge. Like, you could imagine him in a seersucker suit, all of that type stuff. And one of the first things he says, you know, I've seen you on this show with Dan Lebatard and Pepe. And please understand, that's one of Dan's very good friends. The man still can't say his name right. And we refer to Poppy as Pappy.
That's right. He still does it. Still does both. Still does both.
And so we got to the end of the conversation. And I remember the skipper said, I understand that it can be very easy to get lost at this company, which was absolutely a concern I had, right? It's very easy to get lost at this company, but when you have friends at this company like me and Eric Rideholm and Dan Lebatard, it becomes a lot harder for you to get lost at this company. And I remember I said, oh, okay. And I got off the phone and I hung up, And I called my agent because we had been on the three-way on the call. And my agent, who, of course, keeping in mind, has already worked out this deal with other people, right? Like, he's got a completely different set of concerns here than I do because he's got to talk to these people again, right? And so I called my agent, and I'll never forget, I said, so what'd you think? And his response was, he had me at Pappy. I was like, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe that I just got charmed like this. Like, I was like, I just wanted to throw it at him. If he wanted me to turn around and throw it at him from the back, I would have done that too. Like, whatever it took, I could not believe that this happened. And it completely altered the direction of my life. Like, it was the best decision for me to make. It worked out fantastically. It had some ups and downs and getting figured out and everything else, but nothing about my life is the same if the decision goes in the other direction. Nothing at all.
You would have been a star either way. You would have gone to Fox. They would have treated you like a star, and they probably would have made you a star faster than ESPN did.
Yeah, I don't know. The thing is, it doesn't work out the way it does for me if I'm not on that particular TV show that I wound up on, and I'm very aware of that, and that's very important. Like, I've been on a TV show that worked out as a great fit. I've been on a TV show that worked out as a not great fit. Being on the great fit, it matters. It matters a great deal. I also, by the way, left out the point at this at some point, and I don't remember exactly when it was, when a drunken Dan Levitard called me and said, I want you to stay. I want you to be on the show. And I was like, wow, you must be eating this. That might be the last voicemail I've ever checked, by the way, because I never check voicemails, but I checked that one.
Not enough time, Bomani. Thank you for making it. I'm sorry we played so much AAN for the first 30 minutes of this. I enjoyed talking to you, though. We'll do it again.
Oh, good, man.
Thanks to Bomani Jones. You can get more of him. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is a podcast you should be listening to. We will talk to him again. I know Roy had a bunch of questions that we did not get to, so we will talk to him again because there was a lot of subject matter I didn't cover with him. A reminder to please rate, subscribe, and review to Levitard and Friends Network. You've got a bunch of different podcasts there on the menu. Levitard and Friends, rate, subscribe, and review. We will talk to you again next week.